This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manicero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manicero, and this is a show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes, type in Old Dog, spelled D-A-W-G, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, today we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to take a look at something we talk a lot about, but haven't really had a show on this topic. But what I'm referring to is passive investing. Now, passive investing is defined as an investment strategy that aims to maximize returns over the long run by keeping the amount of buying and selling to a minimum. The idea is to avoid the fees and the drag on performance. Now, this is probably pertaining to, let's say, buying in the market or through your stockbroker. Passive investing is not aimed at making quick gains or getting rich with one great bet, but rather on building slow, steady wealth over time. Also known as a buy and hold strategy, passive investing involves buying a security with the intention, it could be a security or it could be, let's say a security with the intention of owning it for many years. Unlike active traders, passive investors are not attempting to profit from short-term price fluctuations or otherwise time the market. The basic assumption that underpins a passive investment strategy is that the market generally posts positive returns given enough time. So increasingly, investors are looking for strong investments that will produce yields that will, you know, surpass the just what's available in your local bank and even the market in general. So I think the passive investor is really somebody who's looking for something that will generate cash flow over a period of time. Well, we have with us an ideal guest to address this, and this is Dr. Buck Joffrey. He was a guest on the Old Dogs REI Network podcast back in January of this year. It was podcast number 071, and the podcast was entitled Part-Time Real Estate Investing. And let me just give you a little background on Buck. He is an accomplished physician, entrepreneur, asset manager, and podcaster. Since finishing his medical training in 2008, he has gone from being broke to having an eight-figure net worth, sharing some of his strategies and investment expertise to help some of his high-paid professional colleagues. He started a financial education website called wealthformula.com, and he hosts the popular Wealth Formula podcast as well. Buck knows the old mantra of investing in a diversified portfolio of stocks, bonds, and mutual funds is outdated and dangerous for high-paid professionals given the volatility and instability of the current global economy. Therefore, he advocates entrepreneurship and or investing in hard assets that provide a cash flow as a more reliable way of approaching personal finance. Through a strong foundation of financial education and emphasis on cash flowing investing, Buck teaches professionals how to take charge of their money and prosper. Well, Buck, it's great to have you back. Welcome back to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Well, it's quite an introduction there.
Well, you know, I tried to put a little bit of everything in there, a little definition of passive investing,
yeah.
And then getting into some of your background.
Because yeah, thanks for having me.
It's great having you on. It's really great. You know, I looking at this subject, you know, we had talked about this quite a bit, and I'm also a listener to your podcast, which is a great podcast, by the way, and there's a lot of discussion about investments and types of investments and so forth. And I thought maybe you could just kind of, start us off here as we explore this area of passive investing, just your own personal philosophy regarding investing.
Yeah, that's a good question because, I mean, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, Bill. My focus when I talk on my podcast and what I teach really focuses on some of the principles of real asset cash flow investing. So, you know, investing in things that are, as you said, cash flowing, things that are, that you understand, that are not layers and layers of complexity, which are usually just designed by Wall Street. When these products have complexity to them, complexity is just a way to suck off profit. So staying away from those kinds of things. You've got, again, the idea of real assets that you can have some ownership in directly, as opposed to intangible paper assets. So you want to be able to, you know, presumably see them, touch them, feel them, that kind of thing. And then be able to utilize things like to leverage and velocity and principles that create wealth. So those are the things that I talk about, and those are the things that I consider sort of the principles of investing. But I think the other thing to remember is that, you know, as long as you know the rules, you can break them. I think the challenge is for most people is trying to have a fundamental philosophy in investing, and then once you establish that and you see opportunity and maybe it doesn't fit into your box, there's no need to be rigid if you feel like confident about it. So
yeah, I mean, it's I've always been an investor. I usually very active in the stock market until, you know, more recently, as we've had these huge, you know, downturns and upturns, and talk about volatility. You know, the market as a whole is pretty pretty active right now, but at the same time, people are concerned, and there's, you know, the economists that are constantly saying, you know, we're overdue for another downturn, and so I started pulling out more and more, and that's actually when I started getting involved in real estate investing. But you know, it's not like I don't think that the market in itself is. It's still a good place to invest, but there's definitely a lot more involved. Like you said, you know, you've got to go through layers and layers. You've got to study companies, annual reports and dig into their background. You've got to know who the CEO is and who's, you know, who's controlling the reins on those companies. And even with all that knowledge, you end up with the Enrons of the world. And
well, just for clarity, I mean, I am very much anti-Wall Street. I don't invest in anything in Wall Street. I limit my own to private placements, but not all my private placements are necessarily going to be restricted to the box that I draw. Here's the thing. You want to know what my, at the end of the day, what I like in an investment, I like it when the cards are stacked in my, on my side,
in your
right?
favor.
So if I know, one of the things that we talk about on my show and which I advocate strongly for is the concept of a tribal investment. And what I mean by that is if you stick with people who you know, like, or trust, or at least, you know, somebody you know knows, like, or trusts or whatever, you've at least got a chance, okay? Because then you can look at what they're presenting to you and then, you know, take it seriously. The rest is on you to figure out whether it fits into your, you know, personal investment philosophy. But I think the problem when you, for me, is that with Wall Street is that I just, you know, I'm not really a retail investor to the extent that I don't want to put in money just to bolster the profits the guys in Wall Street are making. If I'm going to invest in something, I want to be one of the first people who sees money, not, you know, one of the people who adds to my profits because you're downstream of me. Does that make sense? So there are ways to, you know, and I think my point is simply this, is that as a sponsor, and obviously I'm a real estate, you know, syndicator and sponsor, just like you and others out there. We as a sponsor, you know, you have a unique perspective of being able to see how deals are put together, et cetera. And, you know, what makes a good deal, what makes a bad deal, why you want to invest in things. But my only point is that same philosophy and that same perspective does not have to be limited just to the real asset category. I mean, again, this is, again, real estate, et cetera, that makes up about 80% of my portfolio. But especially when you're in a situation right now where you're at the top of the real estate cycle, you have to be able to be flexible. You know, otherwise you're just going to be sitting on dollars, which is probably not a good place to be right now. And so my point is that if you know, like, and trust people, and if you for some reason have an ability to have cards stacked in your favor, then I think you have, you know, that's the way I like it. I don't like things that are purely speculative. And right. But if I know somebody who's doing something and I know that they are the best in the world at something or one of the best around and they're doing something, I might want to get in on it. You know what I mean? And it may not have to do with real estate.
Now, do you, you know, so you don't touch, let's say, index funds, annuities, anything like that
no,
as well?
No, okay. not at all.
Yeah, that's actually refreshing because I don't feel comfortable. And there's too many factors way beyond my control. And it makes it difficult to feel comfortable with that kind of an investment.
Well, I mean, there's lots of reasons not to. First of all, you know, I think the average load on, you know, on mutual funds, which make up a lot of people's portfolio, is somewhere 3 or 4%. So that means if you invest $1,000 in something, I mean, 3% of it came off the second you invested it. And then it keeps coming, off every year. And, you know, you see the wealth advisors walking around talking about, you know, these different buckets that are growing at different paces. Well, they're talking about the markets in general, potentially, theoretically, over a very long period of time, but they're not factoring in the fees. So the reality is that in the last three decades, mutual funds have actually averaged a growth of about 3.5%, which, you know, is you know, if you take into consideration inflation of at least 2%, you're making probably about 1% on your money. And that's really not growth. There's no way you're going to get wealthy doing that. So that's why I stay away from that. And even if you get off of, to your point about you stay away from mutual funds, and people say, well, gosh, you know, I'm in index funds and, you know, there's not a lot of fees there because I'm in Vanguard, et cetera. I mean, yeah, listen, if you are looking and talking to a wealth advisor and they're showing you one of those pretty growth curves of compounding interest, or the magic of compounding interest, well, that concept is called velocity, And it does work when it's going up, right? But the problem is that in the last three decades, if you look at the late 90s, you look at 2008, and even in earlier than that, Bill, this is not, I don't remember it well, but it, I think 87, right? So almost like clockwork, you've got every decade a massive correction. Those never get factored in. And for your listeners in particular, who are folks that are starting to ponder ponder the idea of retirement, you know, do you want to get caught with your pants down in the middle of a correction? You know, it's just not a, it's not a place where I want to be. And it's, to me, that's like being in a casino.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, just look at the people in, you know, 2009 and 2008. I mean, that, there were a lot of people that just lost their entire pensions. And, so yeah, I mean, there's a need, I think, and it's prudent to be very, very cautious about anything that, you know, you invest in.
Right.
Now, yeah, when I started this off, I talked about, you know, passive investment. I mean, do you feel that, what would you say your investment of a, your idea of a passive investment, or how would you define passive investment?
Well, I define it a little bit differently, because I don't think it necessarily means that you're always looking for a long-term, you know, cash flowing asset. I mean, certainly that's, you know, most of what I advocate doing and what you advocate doing. But I mean, listen, there, I've had situations where, you know, I've done a note for someone and gotten 3% per month. You know what I mean?
Right,
it's so that's not really a long-term thing. I mean, if you feel comfortable in a situation like that, yeah, I mean, I'll do that. That's not my investment of choice, but, you know, again, you can be nimble. And if you know the rules and you know a little bit of something, then you can break those rules. Yeah.
So. Now, with yourself and kind of taking a look at your approach now, do you always invest for cash flow, or are there other sort of longer term, it's a longer term focus for you?
I think it's both, for the most part. I'm going to give you my generalized philosophy because, again, you know, I'm doing some things these days because of the market of where it is that I may not do in other markets, you know.
Sure.
You know, here's the thing is that the answer is it depends. For the most part, I always want cash flow. But the question is, when you look at a deal as a passive investor, you know, what are you looking at? Are you looking at, you know, cash flow only for some reason? Or are you looking at, you know, are you looking at something that has potential upside in 5 years, et cetera? So I think that, you know, maybe a good exercise would be to say, okay, well, what kinds of things are you looking at when I look at a passive investment possibility? Why don't I go through that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that'd be great.
That.
Yeah.
Because I think that might help you. So the first thing I'm going to do, if, you know, and this happens to me frequently, by the way, where people send me something and say, hey, this is a great opportunity. I either want you to invest, or maybe I want you to, you know, co-sponsor this because I have my own investor group of accredited investors. And I look at it the same way, frankly. I look at it, you know, the same way, because I want to have, if I sponsor something, I want to have something that the investors, I would invest in myself. So the first thing I want to know is who's a sponsor. Okay. And the sponsor for me, they're going to be either two things. Again, somebody who I know, like, or trust, is in, to have a good reputation, or somebody who I know, like, and trust has invested with this person and has had good results, you know? So there's that credibility issue, because at the end of the day, if you cannot get past that point, everything else you're going to look at in this deal is meaningless, right? Because you can make anything look good in underwriting. You know, I can sell you a swampland in Florida and make it look like you're going to make 20% annualized return on a pro forma. You know, it's too easy to do. So I need to be able to trust what I'm looking at first and foremost. And that's where the whole idea that I call again, I call tribal investing comes in, which is, okay, is this person part of my tribe? You know, is this person a degree or two from me? And do they have some sort of responsibility, you know, social responsibility not to mislead me, right? That's my first and foremost thing. And I don't know if that sounds too, you know, esoteric, but that's a big thing for me and it served me well. The second thing is, okay, for me, if let's specifically talk about multifamily real estate, because that's, again, about 80% of what I'm interested in at any given time. For me, at that point, it comes down to looking at, okay, all right, well, somebody's coming with a deal and they've got an opportunity. Is it a market I want to invest in? Okay, so when you look at markets, obviously there's different things that you can look at. And, you know, a lot of people like to talk about emerging markets, you know, where you can jump in early and there's a huge opportunity for appreciation. Now, I think those are great opportunities if they are indeed emerging markets. And I think you have to, as an investor, start to do a little bit of homework and try to understand why that might be. Let me give you an example. I had an investor recent, or I had an opportunity recently. I just didn't like the numbers, but I do like the market in Reno, of all places. And it could, why? Because Tesla's adding all sorts of factories there, and there's a huge number of jobs coming, and they just don't have enough. They don't have enough. They don't have enough housing.
Right.
So that is, there's plenty of reason for me to truly believe that it's an emerging market. Okay. Or are you looking at does that make you feel comfortable, or does that make you feel a little bit nervous about that? Well, there's a level of speculation there. Or you could go to a robust market, right? Like I'm a big fan of Dallas-Fort Worth. Why? Because it's been growing, you know, as fast as China, you know, and right. and even in the downturn, it's been growing like crazy. And it's just unbelievable. The market, I love it. Or, you know, there's some people who say, you know what, I just want to max out my cash on cash, and that's all I care about. I don't really care about appreciation. Well, right now, and most of the time, you're going to be looking probably about in the middle of the country, right? You're going to be looking at places that don't really go up much. They don't really go down much, etc. But once you can kind of look at it that way and figure out what you feel comfortable with, the next thing you have to do is, at that point, is look at the underwriting, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the underwriting, how you look at that depends very much on everything else we've talked about so far. Who's the sponsor? You know, and also, you know, what is the location of this property? What's the upside in this property, et cetera. Now, I will say that, you know, I think people get hung up a little bit too much on just the cash flow. I think cash flow is really important. I'm not going to invest in anything where there's not cash flow. But here's the problem that I've seen a few times where syndicators are smart. And I'm not saying they're criminals, but they're smart, and they're trying to make money too, right? And there's a lot of folks out there who are trying to figure out, as a sponsor, how are you going to respond psychologically to this investment? And so, if I say to you, Bill, let me give you an example. How do you like the idea? You take all the cash flow. I'm not going to take anything until there's at least 10% return. Right? Sounds pretty good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but on the back end, when we sell this thing in 5 years, I'm going to take, I'm going to take 60% of the profits, and the investors are going to get 40. Do you like that deal still?
Right. Well, then you get a little bit less enthusiastic. Well,
you get less. Well, so here's the problem, right? As a passive investor, if you're unsophisticated, you get hung up on the idea of your cash on cash return. But in real estate, for the most part, if you look at it historically, when you really start making money in real estate, it's when you combine cash on cash and capital gains. It's right. Not just, you know, and I'm talking about investing in a larger, you know, syndication deal. So what I'm trying to get at here is, be careful. I mean, there's sort of typical standard splits that you see with sponsors, and there's not a right or wrong one. It depends on the deal. It depends on the sponsor. Sometimes you might see the sponsor doing 20 and giving, you know, giving 80 to investors, or doing a 30-70. Don't just look at the front, look at the back end and understand what it is that, you know, you're comfortable with. Philosophically, as a sponsor, I don't want to change that number on the back end because I feel like that is not really fair to my investors, right? So if I start at 20-80, I want to end at 20-80 with return on capital. And so when I look at that through the lens of a passive investor, I look at it the same way, right? Because I feel like, hey, why would you get more at this point? You're getting plenty in, you know, you're sharing in this as an equity partner, and it's a 20-80 deal. That's the way I want to look at it, or a 30-70 deal. And that's what I signed up for. Because I know that the capital gain side of this on the exit is usually a significant portion of the returns. So to give you an example, in the deals that we underwrite in Dallas, we might be, and it's really hard in Dallas right now, right? But we're looking at value add opportunities, and we might be looking at an average of, you know, 8, 9, 10%, you know, annual cash on cash returns, meaning what you actually get over the course of 5 years, you're going to maybe get somewhere between 8 and 10% per year. But then, because of the value add and the equity that we add, we plan on, you know, making the annualized return at exit closer to 20%, right? So, right. So that's the thing that you have to look at with some level of sophistication. You know, the other thing I'll say is that in terms of the underwriting, now it starts to get into a lot of details that I don't know if you want me to go into or not, but you know, right now it's a tricky time to buy. So if you're buying in Oklahoma City, right, where I don't see a lot of upside there. I mean, I don't see a lot of, you know, I don't see a lot of appreciation happening in Oklahoma. Well, right now, if you buy in Oklahoma, you might be buying cap rates of 6, right? Mm-hmm. What you have to think about is, okay, well, Oklahoma is not going to appreciate much. And what are historical capitalization rates in Oklahoma? Because they're not going to be 6, I guarantee you that, right? You have to look at what people are underwriting for in terms of inflation. Again, I said that you can make anything look good, right? So If you have an underwriting piece that showing inflation at 5%, well, it might be. I mean, the rate we're going at, but right now I wouldn't really count on it more than 2 or 3%. So you got to look at that column. You got to look at why people are, you know, the plan for the vast majority of properties that I see are value add. Okay, well, how are you going to add that value? And is that realistic? Are you showing, you know, if you're showing rent increases, how are you supporting that? You know, are there comps that you're seeing that support that? And what is the difference between your property and that property? You know, so the list goes on, and I hopefully that's not just overwhelming, but it's not a simple thing. But what I will say is this, if you can get down the first thing I mentioned, investing with someone who you know, like, or trust, you're way ahead of the vast majority of people, because hopefully if you've gotten that point, that sponsor's already looked at all those things and you can kind of believe the numbers you're seeing.
Right. That's a great, great point. I think that, you know, that's, to me, you know, that's gotta be top of mind. You know, yeah, I want to look at the person's history, and I want to know, you know, if they've had a series of previous projects where they had, you know, this kind of a return that they're talking about producing in the, you know, what I'm interested in investing in. But I think overall, it really comes down to the person, and it's interesting how you refer to it as the tribal. You know, is that person a part of my tribe? That's a really interesting. I haven't heard that used before, but I completely get that. And that's probably why, you know, you have people that invest with family members and so forth. And it's also a reason people don't invest with family members too, because yeah. it's almost a little bit too close to the tribal relationship too,
yeah.
where you don't, you don't want to, gosh, if it goes bad, which is, can happen with any investment. Mm-hmm. You don't want that to cause some sort of a family rift that will, go on for years and years either. So,
right.
But I kind of like that. It's interesting what you're saying. Like, if you're looking at, you're doing your own underwriting, looking at this project, do you generally look for, let's say, like a historical capitalization rate for a particular area? Because that's just not something I normally see in an offering memorandum.
Yeah, you're not going to see that, but you can, if you look hard, you can figure out. You can figure out what the sponsor is thinking. Again, it's one of those things, right? Like, my background is a surgeon, and I don't practice medicine anymore. Mm-hmm. But, as a surgeon, sometimes, when you start doing an operation, you can see something and recognize what somebody was trying to do there. Maybe somebody was there before and tried to do something, right? Mm-hmm. There's a level of expertise that comes along with it over time when you look at a bunch of stuff, but I think that's part of what happens when you look at a lot of deals. What was your specific question again? I'm sorry, I was going somewhere with this and then I lost my train of thought.
No, it's okay. It's all right. No, it's the idea of a historic.
Oh yeah, yeah. About that. But here's what I was getting at. So you are buying at a certain cap rate, right? And so you have an entering cap rate. And you look at any underwriting, you're going to see what kind of cap rate are you buying at right now. If you're buying in Texas right now, and you're buying in Dallas, you're buying in Austin, whatever, chances are, even in a B class or even C plus class situation, you are probably going to be buying, probably around 5.5, which is, in Dallas, historically, it's, it's like 7, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that's going to be Dallas's new normal. I don't think it'll ever be historically 7.5 again, because I think that market is a different animal than it was, mm-hmm. 20 years ago. But here's where you can tell. And in any underwriting that's a 5-year pro forma, you can look at what the exit cap rate is, right? And right. What I'll tell you right now is that's where I'm catching a lot of, pro formas that I don't like, because we just said that right now we're probably at the top of the cycle. In other words, this market is probably it can't get any hotter. It's gonna cool down, and it always happens, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at a 5-year pro forma and a cap rate coming in is 5.5, and your cap rate going out right now, 5 years from now, in projection is 5.5, it's too low. Mm. Does that make sense?
Right.
I mean, because you're not taking into account where we are in the market right now. So when we are underwriting, and believe me, I'm not claiming to be, Saint Syndication. That's not my point. But when we underwrite, we're looking at what the historical cap rates are, and we're looking at current cap rates. And at the very least, we're going to take an average of historical and current on exit. You see what I mean?
Right, right.
And so to me, again, these things are important, but on the other hand, so I guess my point being that you may not know what the historical is, but right now one thing that you can do is you can look and see if the deal is showing some sort of correction, if there's a 5-year pro forma, because if there's not a correction shown and the exit cap, it's really not a realistic pro forma.
Right. Good point. Really good point. Now, there are a lot of different types of investors? Obviously, there's you have your set of criteria. There's others. For example, you know, I know some folks that will invest in a project without that 3, 5, 7 year exit. Just really they're just interested in a good solid return for their money over a length of time. It could be 10 years, could be 20 years. When you're looking at something, do you have a certain criteria in your own mind that you're looking to get out of it? Like, for example, you talked about just the annualized return or the IRR, for example, of that particular project. Do you look at that as, well, you know, I'm not going to be interested if it's less than 20% or less than 15%. Or does it just really vary from project to project?
I think it varies from project to project, and it varies from syndicator to syndicator. You know, my friend Ken McElroy, which I think a lot of people probably know him as a Rich Dad Advisor. You know, I'll invest in any multifamily project that Ken does because he has such a tremendous track record, and even if he projects something that is, you know, it's less than 20% annualized or something like that, which typically Ken's never going to do, but I'll invest in it. I mean, you can't, the trouble right now is I think that you can't, if you want to continue investing, which I think people ought to, even though we're at the top of the market, if you are looking and just saying, okay, I'm only going to invest if I get this return, and instead that money's sitting in the bank. Now think of what happens to those returns. Even if you do find something, you're going to get the returns, but you held on to that money for an extra 6 months. Well, you have to include that 6 months of hold time in your returns, right? So does that make sense? So yeah. In effect, what you're doing by not deploying capital is decreasing your potential return on investment. So I think that my focus right now in this particular market is quality assets, okay? I personally have no interest in going to, you know, to Oklahoma City or, you know, to the middle of the country for me because I don't know what's happening with the economy. I'm not saying that's a bad play at all. In fact, you know, it might be a good play for a pure cash flow play, but I'm not a pure just cash flow guy. I want upside because of where I am in my own financial place, right? I don't need just more cash and not a lot of upside. But I think it's, you know, I personally prefer to look at the quality of the asset right now. And if I can, you know, if I have a projection of 7 or 8% for cash on cash, but the upside in the market and the team all look really good, and that's really what I'm probably more interested in at this point in time in the cycle.
Right, right. Now, as an investor, and let's say you do the 3 to 5 year exit, and you get this big bonus at the end of it. Now, how are you sort of shielding yourself from the capital gains are you investing out of a self-directed account like a 401k or IRA, allow those funds to go back in via 1031 exchange, you know, by the sponsor? I mean, how are you protecting yourself if you're in a bunch of these different projects and all of a sudden, you know, boom, you've got this huge capital gain all of a sudden?
Yeah.
How are you strategically handling that?
Well, I don't invest in a lot of quick turnover type stuff. I mean, as an investor, you know, I love the idea of buy and hold forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's just that may not always be what other investors like. You know, I like the idea of refi and stay in a deal. So I don't, you know, I'm not in a lot of situations where I have to. You know, I have to worry about that. I think that's a more complicated question because, you know, my own situation is different than a lot of others. I don't have any qualified money at all. I don't do IRAs. I don't do any of that because I just I don't it's a whole nother session, but I don't really believe in it. I use something called a LIRP, a life insurance retirement plan. We have something that, you know, a product actually that we're talking about, which is called Wealth Formula Banking, which is basically a Roth on steroids. And and so that's what I use. And in terms of tax mitigation, I have a number of other strategies. I mean, things that I talk about on my show, but usually are reserved for what we call accredited investors. And so I don't. For my situation, I think it's a little different. But you are going to have capital gains. I think if you use your IRA and if you have IRA money, I think that's a great way to go. You know, let's just leave it at that.
Right, right. Now, you also invest in businesses too, is that correct? Or are you, I know you talked about it one time.
Well, I mean, for the most part, I invest in my own businesses. I can't say that I've gotten into investing in other people's businesses, but, you know, I've got three or four, you know, active cash flowing businesses right now. I look at them as assets. You know, I have invested in a handful of startups. But they've been just because I knew the people who were involved. I'm not very heavily into it. But I think people who invest in business who are really good at it can do really, really well. But it's so strange to me. But I think what I know about being a small business owner is what keeps me away from buying other small businesses. Because so often what happens is that there are intricacies within a small business that the only way you're going to know about it is if you're in that business and you know it extremely well. So the only way I think that you get around that is buying businesses that are sufficiently large. You know, businesses with revenues in the $50, $100 million range and stuff like that, where the management is clearly in place. There's, you know, a lot of clients already and so on and so forth. But, you know, I'm not really in a position to do that myself. So
we're not going to be seeing you on the panel at Shark Tank anytime in the near future.
Well, huh? Maybe at some point, hopefully you will. But I think that, you know, that's the kind of thing where I think if you've got, you know, a lot of money to play around when it's something to think about doing. I mean, for me, like my money that's, you know, speculative is either going into, you know, I'm fascinated by what's going on with, you know, with blockchain and cryptocurrencies, or with junior mining sectors. I've got some connections in that area to people who really, really know what they're doing. It's incredibly speculative stuff. But again, if you have somebody, you know, the old saying, if you're going into a dark tunnel, go with somebody who's been there before. Mm-hmm. That's the only time I'll really go, you know.
Right. So have you done some shows on Bitcoin and some of the cryptocurrencies?
I'm recording one today, and I think it's going to take people by surprise why I'm suddenly so interested in this, because in some respects it sounds like, well, gosh, cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and blockchain and all this stuff, it sounds so much the antithesis of real asset investing. But
yeah, really,
but
I mean, that's even beyond the market, the stock market. I mean,
well, yeah, but the difference is that it's total, you know, you'll have to listen to the show, because I have spent some time learning about this in the last few weeks. And I was, before I knew anything about it, I was like, yeah, right, I'm going to do anything crypto. There's absolutely no way in the world. But I actually believe I would bet everything I own that blockchain technology, which is what currency is built on, is going to happen. And it is already happening and is going to be such a part of our life every day. I mean, I think we're on the dawn of a new internet. And to not have some exposure to that, I mean, it would be like knowing a little bit about what's going on with the internet and not taking a few shots down the field. But if you're not in a position to have some money to play around with, don't do it. So that's
right.
What I'll tell you.
It kind of sounds a little bit like Vegas or something.
Well, yes and no. It's yes and no. But again, I am only going to do this with people who I know, like, and trust, and who stack the cards in my favor, right? We're going to, you know, like I'm part of a let me give you an example. I'm investing in an initial coin offering, as they say in the crypto world, but it happens to be I'm getting a 30% discount on pre-sale. So from before the ICO even happened, so I make 30% what I invest from day one. Mm-hmm. Okay. The second thing is that the people I know in this are super heavy hitters. I mean, guys like Peter Diamandis, from Abundance, et cetera. Right. So it's not like we're going into some, and the CEO who I'm actually interviewing today, later on today, has sold multiple companies for, you know, 9-figure, 10-figure things. So it's not like I'm going in it blindly. If I know that somebody is, you know, I'm not going to go and look on the internet and say, what's the best cryptocurrency to invest in? But if the cards are stacked in your favor, you have an opportunity. And it's pretty rare that happens, you know? So.
Right, right. Wow. Yeah, well, I'm going to listen to that show, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
No, this is great. This is great. Well, our time's just like zipped by here, Buck.
And, sorry about that.
No, it's... This is great stuff, and I'm just going to have you back on again, because I think that there's a lot to be said in this area of investing, especially, and so I want to extend that invitation now, because
anytime, I'd love to be on again. It's always fun talking to you.
Oh man, it's a blast. It's a blast every time I have you on. So, how can people find out more about you and what you're doing, about your podcast? What's the best way folks can find that information out?
Yeah. So, the podcast is Wealth Formula Podcast. Of course, it's, you know, just the way you found Bill's show on iTunes, Stitcher, whatever, wealthformula.com. You can also, you know, I have that 7 Secrets of Eternal Wealth. It was a Amazon bestseller, but I'm giving it away in PDF format. If you're if you don't get to a computer much, you can text 44222 and type in Wealth Formula, one word, and don't let the autocorrect screw you up, and you can get a free copy of that sent to you as well. So 44222 Wealth Formula, and get on my list. And man, we have so much stuff coming up. We have a cool course that we're producing actually in September and October, and so the community's growing. It's super fun, so hopefully some of you will join that.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Buck, for being our guest again. And for those listening, definitely take him up on that and listen to his podcast. He's got some great information. Anybody that's interested in investing and doing it smart, and that's his emphasis. He's, I'd say you're fairly conservative in terms of your approach to investing, and so am I too. You know, especially as I get older here, you know, I don't want to take too many chances with the funds that I have. So, it's a great show. So thank you so much for being on, Buck. I appreciate it. And for all those that are listening, all our old dog listeners out there, thank you for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we greatly appreciate it. As far as the things we've discussed here, everything is going to be outlined in our show notes on the Old Dogs website at olddogsreinetwork.com/blog. And just look for the episode with Dr. Buck Joffrey. So that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.